You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest. We've seen things you people wouldn't believe edition. It's Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. On today's show, Blade Runner 2049 is the sequel to the much-revered and path-breaking sci-fi classic. This one returns Harrison Ford as Deckard, a man tasked with killing synthetic humans when they get out of line. I'll watch what I say. The old one was directed by Ridley Scott. The new one is directed by Denis Villeneuve and stars also Ryan Gosling. And then Transparent is the Amazon streamer starring Jeffrey Tambor, Gabby Hoffman, an incredible ensemble cast. I can't name them all. The sharply observed dramedy of Manners is returning for a fourth season. Finally, Harvey Weinstein was an old-fashioned mogul, a force of nature, a force of culture, combining taste and power to create a generation of classic indie movies. It turns out he is also a serial sexual abuser, we discuss. Joining me today is Isaac Butler. Hey, Isaac.
Hey, Stephen.
I should say, Isaac, you are a Slate contributor, a theater director, and author of The World Only Spins Forward, An Oral History of Angels in America, co-authored with Dan Coyce. Hey, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And of course, Dana Stevens is Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey.
All right, well, let's dig right in. The original Blade Runner was neither a critical nor a commercial hit. When it first came out in 1982, it was a hybrid movie that confused, frankly, I think a lot of people. It combined noir and sci-fi elements, and it was about hybrid creatures, so-called replicants or lab-grown human slaves. And it told the story of the man tasked with hunting them down and killing them when they went rogue. The film was directed by Ridley Scott. It starred Harrison Ford, Sean Young, Rutger Hauer. It's become, in the years since, it's become really a classic. A sequel now arrives directed by Denis Villeneuve. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. He has scored already a contemplative sci-fi hit with the movie Arrival. And this new version stars Ryan Gosling, a Blade Runner in search of answers about both his own origins. And it's Blade Runner about life itself, right? The existential noir is back. Let's listen to a clip. I should say, by the way, this is from the trailer.
I thought you might be able to help me with the case. Any idea where I could find him?
You police plan on taking me in?
I would much prefer that to the alternative.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future, but I can only make so many. I had the lock, and he has the key. I think I found him.
That's not possible.
All right. Well, Dana, there is a lot to discuss here, including I would love to hear everybody's feelings about the original movie, which many people regard as maybe the greatest sci-fi movie ever made, and other people regard as a portentous mess. I think I switch back and forth every time I see it. But let's start at the most natural starting place, which is, what do you think of Blade Runner 2049?
This occupies an unusual relationship to the original, right? It is a sequel, but it's not part of a franchise. And if nothing else you can say this about the original, it it abides, right? I mean, it has persisted in the cultural imagination. It's become this kind of cult classic. Whether it's a good movie or not is almost immaterial to how influential it's been in science fiction. You know, the look of it, the sound of it, the philosophical concerns. I feel like Blade Runner almost started a new era in science fiction. And so it's a very big task, obviously, to come back to that world 32 years later and try to make it come alive again. So does this movie succeed at that? To me, not really. It's certainly visually dazzling and orally dazzling, as you could hear from the soundtrack. That is a very pervasive, omnipresent soundtrack in that clip and throughout the movie. And it stuns you as a spectacle. But to me, as storytelling, it did not really hang together. I found the ending, which I don't want to spoil, but we can sort of hint at in our conversation, very disappointing. What else? I mean, Ryan Gosling is actually quite good as Kay, the main replicant character in the story, the Blade Runner. But does he make sense in the Blade Runner universe? I'm not completely sure. This always felt to me like a hugely portentous piece of fan service. And I'm sorry if that sounds really mean. I enjoyed its unfurling at the time, but it stayed with me almost zero. But we should mention that the production design, I think we can all agree that the production design and cinematography are absolutely dazzling. And I think the only Oscar I'm going to care about this year, I give myself one every year, will be Roger Deakins getting the cinematography award, because he's been up something like 13 times. He's never won. And if there's one thing that stands out about this movie, it's the way that it builds the future world, the 2049 world, and establishes it with the camera.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we should briefly maybe talk about Roger Deakins, right? Because Roger Deakins is the Coen brothers' primary cinematographer from Barton Fink on. You know, he did Sicario, and I believe he also did Arrival, and he did this movie. And his work in, I mean, I guess now that Gordon Willis is dead, he's probably like one of the great English language cinematographers. I mean, it's the absolutely stunning.
I loved it, but not without complication. And I say this as someone who's gotten in trouble for having publicly dissed the first one. To honor the original Blade Runner, one should, and to think about the new one in the context of honoring the old one, one should admit that it was in its conception an anti-movie in some sense. It is not overly traditionally plotted. It is not filled with action. The defining feature of that movie, in addition to its stunning visuals and production values, is the kind of noir longueur, if I'm pronouncing that word right, longueurs of it or whatever. I mean, it's just a slow, languid, dreamy, existentially mopey film, which is its source of its greatness, filled with metaphysical pomp. It's a movie that completely deconstructs the notion of plot, hero, and villainy, and I think it deserves to stand forth as a masterpiece. So all of that said, you know, the screenwriters and Villeneuve had a huge task ahead of them, which is somehow honoring the memory of this original film, getting metaphysical pomp, you know, that and visual splendor as expected of them into it. And I was amazed at how they did it. I mean, there is, in fact, a kind of anti-movie, a totally dignified anti-movie at the heart of this one, Dana, which I found completely satisfying. I don't want to spoil anything about it, but it sets you up for a certain set of cliches that people pretend to find satisfying, though I cannot believe they still find them actually satisfying. And it totally fucking subverts it and bizarrely does manage to tell a kind of human story about what it is human beings will still existentially long for, even when absolutely every facet of their lives is ringed by a kind of imagination and corporeally servicing technology. So I was blown away by it. Now, its flaws are not hard to point out, but they seem to spring from the seed that was the original movie in a way that was completely honest and not overly devoted, by the way, Dana, I think, to servicing fandom and the need for sequels. The degree to which this movie doesn't seem to conform to that was floored me. I really admired it. I have to say, I was shocked. 10 minutes in, I thought I was going to regret the shit out of having to sit there for 3 hours, and I found it a weirdly moody and captivating film that kind of succeeded on its own merits.
I feel like maybe I'm in between you two guys. I will say I feel like I really liked the film, but the more I think about it, the more its internal messiness and incoherence kind of comes to the fore is I think what I feel like. I still like it. I'd still recommend it. I agree with Steven. Just go see it. But, you know, there's certain ways in which the questions that it's asking about kind of what is real and what is human, the human's relationship to the divine as we master the building blocks of life, don't quite connect to its ideas of slavery and freedom, as well as the original film's questions about what does a human do. I will say, I think they did a great job of kind of expanding into the future of, like, you know, taking the world of the original movie and expanding it into like what it would look like 30 years later is way more convincing than a lot of sequels or prequels, or, you know, if you compare it to like the Star Trek movies, which take place before the original series, but they have like floating holograms and crazy touchscreen technology. Well, this actually has the janky technology from the original Blade Runner, where everything looks a little broken. There's brands in the original Blade Runner that have since gone out of business that come back in the sequel. You know, so I really enjoyed all of that stuff.
Yeah, the imagining of the future, I agree, was fantastic. And the fact that we didn't have to start with some big title card explaining, like, there's been a this kind of disaster and then this kind of thing happened.
Yes,
right? We have
exactly.
to just infer it from the setting.
I do think, though, that it's hard to talk about this without spoiling. I do think in the last act of the movie, there is an attempt to seed possible sequels that really screws up the film's denouement and feels very studio note-y. And so there is a way
it didn't for me.
Oh, really? That's fascinating. It's difficult to have a conversation about this movie if you're not going to spoil anything. But it's a very clear scene where they're sort of setting up something that does not happen in this movie that could easily happen in a sequel. And the end of the film starts to feel like a little chaotic, like it's going in a bunch of different directions at the same time without quite investing in any of them. Much the way, you know, there's like biblical references in it and references to Nabokov and references to Kafka and all these other things that don't quite cohere. So there's a messiness that is hidden by how beautiful and carefully filmed it is.
I see. Isaac, I don't disagree with any of the specifics there, but to me, at the heart of that is the thing that we can't spoil. And that to me landed. And once that landed, and I thought it was a daring fucking choice, right? It's absolutely in keeping with the kind of anti-movie, you know, nobility of the first one. I felt as though everything stray and weird, weirdly and maybe inconclusive about the movie did wrap up dramatically, right? But the other thing I want to point to, and we cannot end a segment without talking about it, is in addition to the janky technologies, there's janky Harrison Ford, there's janky Rick Deckard returning. Dana, this was obligatory. It was obligatory in Star Wars. To me, it felt obligatory in Star Wars and did not feel obligatory here. I thought Harrison Ford prepared a lot to be in this film and looked like he had emotionally prepared to be in it. And I again, like, cathexis set in for me about 30, 35 minutes into this movie, so all of my critical faculties went out the window. I was in love with him and his return as Rick Deckard. I thought he was tremendous. Good in this film.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. He needed to be in it. It was not at all a nostalgic cameo. Let's take a peek at Harrison Ford. It was really the character returning and playing a crucial role in the story. And he and Gosling actually had a real chemistry together. I wish he'd been in more of the movie. Yeah, I have no case to make against the actors, the job they did, even the story that was constructed around them. I think the things about this movie that I would take issue with is it does seem like it's setting up sequels. I think it seems more like a studio product than the first one did, and less kind of having the courage of its own convictions to be something strange and standalone. But maybe that's inevitable given that it is itself a sequel. I think it's too long. It's too humorless. And I just think it loses energy. The energy kind of dissipated for me in the last few minutes, and the ending was very sort of, is that all there is? But, you know, I would send people that feel strongly about the first one should absolutely go and see what happened to this story 20, 30 years later. Can I say one sort of thematic? There was a science fiction sort of idea expressed through a character or sort of a group of characters that I really loved. And if there are sequels, I would like to see this explored. And that was Joy.
Joy was amazing. Best part of the movie.
Incredible, right? So Joy is the what would you call her? The digital girlfriend of Ryan Gosling's Kay, the main character who's a replicant. And the sort of supposition in this future is that you can, it's not unlike Her, Spike Jonze's film Her, except that Joy also has, you know, a physical manifestation as this kind of holographic projection. And so she is a digital girlfriend who can be anything you want her to be. This, of course, makes it sound like she's going to be all about objectification and that she's going to be a mere kind of digital sex doll. But in fact, she seems to be what the replicants were in the first Blade Runner, right? A sort of non-human creation that's vying for or striving toward or longing for humanity. And she does seem to have some sort of emotional and intellectual life separate from the Ryan Gosling characters. She can shift appearance. She can be sort of carried around in this little pocket-sized holder that will allow her to go out into the world, but that gives her certain limitations as to her mortality. You sort of learn those laws as you go along. And in a really, really wonderful, probably the best visual effect of the movie, and again, one that is truly expressing an idea, there are these giant Joys, like I would say they're 10 stories tall or something, these avatars of her, because of course she can be bought in duplicate, wandering the streets of this future Los Angeles, sometimes naked. One is dressed as a ballerina and is dancing in toe shoes. And so as people are, you know, moving through these murky, futuristic, post-apocalyptic spaces, there are these giant women walking among them, essentially selling digital avatars of themselves. And that is such a dark and fascinating and smart way of thinking about what the future of the commodification of sexuality might be.
Totally.
Yes.
That I really hope it gets explored more if there are more movies.
There's another scene in the film, which I won't spoil, involving Joy that is like, and it's largely wordless, and it's one of the most beautiful, powerful things I've seen in cinema. The thing that I find interesting about this movie is the original Blade Runner has been so influential on cyberpunk and science fiction that the things it's influenced now influence its sequel. And that's, I think, one of the fascinating things to watch.
Yeah, completely agree. Okay, well, I think there are three thumbs up of varying degrees of enthusiasm, but go see it, Blade Runner 2049, and discuss it with us at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on. All right, before we go any further, I think we have some business, don't we, Isaac? Are you're handling our business now? You're filling those shoes?
Is Isaac that much of a fop, Steve? Can he read the business today?
I think of this really as a test. We'll determine it based on how well you do.
I just want to say I'm a fop in all sorts of different senses of the term. First, our Slate podcast pick of the week is Hit Parade, Chris Malamphy's brilliant podcast about the stories behind chart-topping hits. Chris is fascinated by how music becomes and stays popular. And so far, Hit Parade has examined the week the Beatles swept the entire Billboard Top 5 and the surprising history of UB40's Red Red Wine. Most recently, he took on the music industry's war against the retail single, which would contribute to the massive contraction in the music industry in the early 2000s. So check out Hit Parade in its own feed. Just search for Hit Parade wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd like to let you know that Slate is putting on a really cool event in New York on November 8th. It's called The People vs. Trump Year One, featuring Jamel Bowie, Isaac Chotiner, Dahlia Lithwick, Julia Turner, and more. It's a series of one-on-one conversations with those at the forefront of politics, media, the law, and activism as they compare notes on the lessons, challenges, and victories they've seen over the past year and what they expect from the next. That's at 7:30 p.m. on November 8th at the New School Auditorium in New York. Go to slate.com/live for tickets and information. In Slate Plus today, we'll be talking about how McDonald's ran afoul of Rick and Morty's rabid fan base. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. If you enjoy this podcast and find it valuable, joining Slate Plus is a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing these shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of the show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other great benefits, including extra segments each week. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. Steven, how did I do?
You filled one shoe, maybe?
Yeah, all right.
but Isaac, you know, you've been a fop for a long, long time.
He's heading toward UFOP status, ultimate friend of the program.
I think he's got to go through SFOP first, Dana. This is a rigidly hierarchical organization.
When do I get a top hat and tails? That's all I'm wondering.
On that note, Transparent is the TV program from the showrunner Jill Soloway. It follows the Pfefferman family as its
beloved patriarch or ambivalently loved patriarch transitions from man to woman. Through three seasons, we followed the both malignantly narcissistic monsters and sympathetic human beings that each of the Pfeffermans is. The show is rapidly approaching classic status. What is it about other than what I've said already? It's about how living in the present is impossible without also living in the past, which is always real and alive, all the way back to Nazi Germany. It's about a family pervaded by secrets and lies. It's about how gender and sex pervade everything we do. It is non-dogmatic and smart, dramedy of manners. I love it. Let's listen to a clip from season four.
You're going to Israel. Imagine. How many hours is that flight? 14, 15 hours?
No idea.
I think it's so cool you're teaching me.
I think it's great.
I love it. I love, you know.
What exactly are you going to be doing over there?
In Israel.
Yeah.
They call it...
Keynoting.
Keynoting. And they use it as a verb. And Judaism, Cold War, and gender is the name of my lecture.
Wow. Triple threat.
Oh, seriously?
Seriously. Cool. That is cool.
You guys, I think we should raise a glass.
Really cool. All right.
Something. Yeah. Mazels.
Cheers. Your return to academia.
Next year. To the motherland.
I would like to go to Israel before I die. I planted a tree there.
We all planted trees there. I think it's a scam.
No, it's not.
Put all the money and planted trees like so the next group has a place to plant them.
Right?
No,
it's in the Negev.
You went junior year?
Yeah, it's my first hand job.
Oh, my God.
Whatever else is true about the show, it wouldn't work if it weren't very, very funny, which it just, to this day, to me, it remains. If it didn't work as a comedy, it wouldn't work as everything else complicated that it is. What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think the third season was in many ways its maybe least comic. And I think it returns. There's a kind of comedy of manners that comes in the fourth season as the Pfeffermans journey to Israel that I think is really fascinating. I connect to the show in a whole bunch of different ways. In many ways, I connect to it through my younger brother, who is both an observant Jew and trans. And although he doesn't watch the show because he actually just finds the inter-character dynamics too uncomfortable and too painful. But I think it's really sharply written. It reminds me of all of my favorite dysfunctional Jewish family dramedy plays from the 90s that I used to go see in Washington, D.C. And I think it's a really wonderful work. It is also, as I, you know, argued in a piece for Slate, a very important work of specifically Jewish art that is interested in this specific Jewish milieu of essentially secular Los Angeles wealthy Jews. And is also thematically concerned in many ways with sort of the themes and ideas of kind of American Jewish art.
Yes, I absolutely totally agree. That's the kind of hidden heart of the show, beneath the central MacGuffin of Jeffrey Tambor transitioning. Dana, what about you? How do you feel about this TV show?
Oh, I just wish I'd been watching it all along now. I mean, my trajectory with it is that we talked about it back when it was one of those Amazon pilots, you know, on a menu of pilots that might or might not be picked up. I think if I remember right, it was in the very first offering that Amazon gave of, you know, people will vote on which of these shows should be picked up. So we talked a little bit more about that gimmick probably than the show itself. But we did talk about the pilot here and maybe one more episode. Then I proceeded to not watch any of the rest of it while accumulating praise from all different friends and feeling like I really wanted to. And then for this segment, Isaac kindly caught me up on everything that happened in seasons two and three. As he correctly stated, there's sort of a reset after those two seasons. So once you start season four, you sort of know all the characters from the pilot, and those are the main, that's everybody who goes to Israel over the course of season four. And so because it's so addictive, the show, it's only half an hour long. It tends to end on kind of emotional cliffhanger moments. And I wound up watching 9 episodes in a row, so I've seen all but one from season 4. And now I'm going to go back and fill in the holes because it's wonderful. It's just wonderful writing. This family completely comes alive. And yes, there's that attempt, which is very common now in cable television shows, to create these awful, narcissistic characters that are still somehow lovable. But to me, the lovability really prevails by season 4. There's really a warmth in this family and a sense that everyone's story matters in the family. It's not at all just Maura's story of coming out as trans. There are so many stories going on besides Maura's. There's all 3 of her children having, you know, various gender and sex related and also just professional and, you know, addiction related and other kinds of encounters and traumas and problems to solve. And then there's the character played by Judith Light, Shelley, the wife of Mora, who has now established this friendship with her that in season four I've really loved seeing develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it gets at something so true about how families, in addition to being an aggregation of individuals, are also also constitute a single living organism, and health and sickness kind of get distributed. You know, there's been 20 years now, I mean, since Seinfeld, of malignant narcissism excused as funny, and a way for all of us to excuse our own malignant narcissism through the kind of ultimate horrible lovability of such characters. I think this completely transcends that dialectic in a way. The show is so perceptive about what makes a person, and how shot through with, you know, hypocrisy and befuddlement people are, and what they're trying to work out with one another. And there's a wonderful moment where Jeffrey Tambor, where Mora says to Gabby Hoffman, warns her against, I think, the relationship with Cherry Jones, who plays an Eileen Miles-like a feminist poet with whom she strikes up a quite complex sort of mentor-mentee relationship. And anyway, that's also that they're also having an affair. And Jeffrey Tambor says something about, well, don't get too involved. He says something about it being too dogmatic, right? And for a show that's so self-consciously derived from the gender studies revolution that happened in the 80s and 90s on American campuses, its inability to be dogmatic about anything or anybody is, to me, is just a remarkable achievement. So, Isaac, I completely agree with you. There's something about the subtlety with which the actual portraits are being drawn, not only on the page, but in each of the performances, right? I mean, there's just the kind of leitmotif throughout the whole show where the three siblings all go off alone and interact with one another, which has clearly been a coping mechanism of theirs, you know, since they grew up in a household with a lot of secrets and unexpressed desires in it, ill-expressed desires in it. And every one of those just rings so true. I often wonder whether they're improvised. I mean, they just have such a spontaneity to them. It's really a beautifully realized work of, you know, popular and dramatic art, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And one of the things that, at least for me, made the third season kind of difficult going is that it scatters the three siblings and they rarely spend any time on camera together. And so when they do at the end of the third season, it's a real relief to see them together again. And the fourth season has a lot of them kind of bottled up in a bus together. I think you hit on something that's really important, which is that, you know, Transparent isn't dogmatic. It develops its themes and its ideas dialectically. There's always argument. There's always another argument to be made.
Which is very Jewish as well, right?
It's very Jewish, right?
It's a Seder dinner with everybody yelling at each other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so what I think is really bold is that it takes that approach and brings it to bear on a subject that it's basically been left off screen for most of the show, which is Israel and Zionism. And the result is that you have an American television show saying things that I never thought I would hear on American television, maybe in my lifetime. You know, there's a scene where one of the characters refers to the settlements as stolen land, for example. And there's a part where activists connected to BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement, which is looking to bring financial pressure on Israel to end the occupation, you know, where they're given room to speak their viewpoint. But the show then takes that viewpoint and puts it in contrast with, you know, hardcore Zionists, sort of mealy-mouthed liberals who don't know what they're talking about. You know, like it all exists as part of that ongoing Seder table screaming match that makes the show so thrilling and so delightful.
All right. Well, season four of Transparent has dropped. It's binge ready in case you haven't gotten to it already. As always, we are eager to hear what you think about it at facebook.com/culturefest. We regard it as a terrific show still in its prime. All right. Moving on.
Just a note, Benjamin Frisch, producer, dropping in here to say that Tuesday, while we were recording the show, Ronan Farrow's New Yorker piece about Harvey Weinstein came out, but we did not see it during our recording, and which is why it's not referenced in this segment. Thanks.
Well, now a very, I'm sorry to say, dreary topic. Harvey Weinstein was thought of as kind of an old-fashioned mogul, a throwback. He was, as I said, a force of nature, a force of culture. He combined taste and power, created a generation of classic indie movies like Good Will Hunting and Pulp Fiction. Turns out he was an old-fashioned mogul in another way. The casting couch apparently accompanied him everywhere. And I think that that's just a glib way to put it relative to, frankly, relative to how utterly repulsive his behavior apparently was, for which he has now been fired by the company that bears his own name. In addition to the stories of revolting behavior and his firing, now comes also a symbolic fight over Hollywood's complicity in a culture of sexual abuse, as many women prominent in that industry have come forward, prominent among them, Lena Dunham, who wrote beautifully about it for the New York Times, are now saying, and also predictably from the American right, accusation of a huge double standard that Fox News was had its feet held to a very different fire than left-wing Hollywood is. I don't think there's much substance to that. I doubt you guys will either, but it is certainly worth mentioning. Dana, let me start with you. You attend festivals. You go to screenings. You are what every film critic is, kind of part of it, kind of not part of the monster known as Hollywood. How much of this had you heard about previously? And talk to me what your reaction is now that it's out in the open.
Honestly, I mean, this is maybe indication that I'm not doing enough reading of the trades or something, but this came as a total surprise to me. I mean, that there is this kind of sleaze going on in the industry is not shocking to me, but that Weinstein in particular was perpetrating these acts over this long period of time. There's a long story by Anne Helen Peterson in BuzzFeed talking about, you know, essentially the whisper campaign, or campaign is the wrong word, but the whisper network that has existed about these rumors within Hollywood for all of these years, and that there have been blind items on Page Six, and that she mentions that there have been jokes dropped about this on various shows, including 30 Rock. And I guess to me, maybe because I'm in New York and not within the industry and not writing on the industry per se, but just on its products, this had completely gone over my head. And so these allegations were surprising and shocking to me. And I guess I would have to come to the defense of someone like, for example, Meryl Streep, who wrote a letter, a sort of, you know, public condemnation of Harvey Weinstein, saying, I knew nothing about all of this, and was then roundly, you know, lambasted on Twitter for supposedly lying and covering up and defending him. It seems to me completely credible that a person who lives in Connecticut, as Meryl Streep does, and is as immensely powerful in the industry, I mean, he needs her obviously much more than she needs him, right? That she would not have been privy to or subject to this treatment. It was something that went down to the less powerful, not up to the more powerful.
I also think it is absolutely crazy making to me that, like, where we're going now is let's attack Judi Dench and Meryl Streep.
Oh yeah.
It's wholly predictable that the conversation would quickly move to like Fox News point scoring and let's figure out a way that we can blame women for it. But it's still absolutely revolting. I think that when these kinds of stories come out, I think it is in many ways a moment for lots of us to think about ways that we might be complicit in these sorts of systems without meaning to be or without knowing that we are. You know, it's an opportunity, I think, for a lot of us to think about ways that we may be complicit in these systems, whether we mean to be or not. But the way that we as a culture turn this into, you know, liberal and conservative point scoring or ways to further attack women has been really upsetting to watch.
And I have to say, it's not just women. There was an article in The Guardian this morning that was sort of condemning this paragraph long list of male stars who have not responded yet to the controversy. The quickness with which all of this becomes, you know, a sort of virtue signaling, right? And a way of showing that you're on the right side of history is really one of the more unappealing, you know, aside from Weinstein's behavior itself, is one of the more unappealing things about this whole story.
Right. I mean, and it's I mean, this is a narrative that has a villain. The villain's name is Harvey Weinstein. The idea that we're being morally deep or subtle by pointing the finger elsewhere is absolutely disgusting and wrongheaded. I mean, and I want to say that the Lena Dunham piece I really want to point to again, I think you guys agree, was uniquely precise, lucid, morally correct in a serious way about the issue of Hollywood's complicity and a culture of silence. I mean, she says, men of Hollywood, what are you sorry for? What will you refuse to accept anymore? There is obviously, I'm now contradicting myself, but there is obviously a way in which extrapolating from Harvey Weinstein to a culture of sexual abuse in Hollywood
is morally imperative. The idea that the women of Hollywood are part of that circle of complicity, or that it somehow breaks into a left and right divide, that's monstrous and completely wrongheaded. I will, however, say one thing, which is that in the midst of an otherwise very bad axe-grinding Weekly Standard article that I sort of resent having agreed to read, a very good point was made, which is that among the reasons why this was allowed to happen unreported for so long, in part, was there's an old culture of power that's now collapsing. And that not only has to do with something like the beginnings of the collapse of the theatrical release model in which Weinstein and Miramax thrived, which is kind of a movie budgeted between $15 and $50 million, that mid-budget prestige film. That market has shrunk drastically in favor of streaming and tentpole, huge tentpole releases. So that was happening to begin with. But the larger point he made, which I thought was somewhat perceptive, was, you know, there was a nexus of glossy magazines, you know, kind of Condé Nast, back when Condé Nast was a juggernaut and had a ton of power, and its flagship Vanity Fair was at the center of it, the kind of Tina Brown universe of the 1990s, as it bled a little bit into the post 9/11 world, involved enormous amounts of horse trading, access for publicity, and relatively small Rolodex of players at the upper end negotiating with one another in order to keep the behemoth alive and omnipresent, and Harvey Weinstein was at the center of it. I mean, he knew all of those people. He knew who to call to crush a story or to discourage one. And so I do think that world has fallen apart, right? Like, the journalism now is no longer as clearly, especially in the age of the internet, but also the collapse of print as a business model, is no longer at the center of this kind of tentacular beast in which someone might be able to enforce silence quite as easily. But I want to return to the other point, which is that I hate as much as anybody the left-right political divide being somehow superimposed on this story. That just seems egregiously stupid and frankly masturbatory to me. That said, isn't there something to be thought through about Hollywood's relationship to both sex and power, in the sense that we so expect, in a way, that it's populated by enormously powerful men and very vulnerable and very beautiful young women who are fame seeking, and that we have a kind of we do have something of a double standard when it comes to Hollywood, that we expect that this is happening. I mean, wouldn't it be I guess the way of asking the question is, wouldn't this be a watershed moment in American morals if all of a sudden what are now becoming hopefully more universal standards of respect and equity in the workplace were actually really rigorously enforced in Hollywood?
Yeah, I mean, the rigorous enforcement seems like it's going to be a long ways away, maybe generations away. But even the fact that there's this kind of breaking up of, you know, what was such an established, I mean, you know, I can't go making allegations about people that are long gone, but these kind of discussions have been happening since Hollywood has existed. And in all the research that I've been doing about early film, you know, there is absolutely in place a patriarchal system where young, beautiful women in the 20s were flocking to Hollywood trying to get cast. And there were all kinds of scandals having to do with moguls essentially handing them around or having parties to which young actresses were invited as essentially planned escorts, you know, for other rich moguls. And that whole world has been so hidden for so many generations that it does feel like, as do many things in the Trump era, as if something ugly that was always there just out of sight has just broken into view. I have no idea what the next step is to try to dismantle that system, but it seems like people are starting to ask for it and press for it.
Yeah, and I also think another thing that's happened, and this is a positive thing, is norms around what is newsworthy in this subject matter, I think, have changed pretty rapidly because of, largely, I think the turning point is actually Cosby and the Cosby allegations. One of the pieces we read for this week was a piece in The Wrap where a reporter says that she brought these, you know, some collection of Weinstein wrongdoing stories to the New York Times in the early aughts, and they didn't pursue the story. They said, he's not a politician or, you know, a public, he doesn't hold public office, so I don't understand why this is newsworthy, which itself is a change from the, you know, Clinton impeachment trial, where we're like, well, does this really matter? You know, a lot of people were like, you know, well, but does this really matter that he cheated on his wife or whatever? And so now it's like, well, but he's not a politician. And then Cosby happens. And now it's like, actually, these are powerful public figures. And these stories are newsworthy. I think the Weinstein story hopefully will create an opening for more of these kinds of stories to be, you know, rigorously reported and released, and will hopefully lead to the kinds of shifts that we're talking about.
As recently as the show Entourage, which I think I saw mentioned in somebody's, maybe it was Lena Dunham, in somebody's response to this Harvey Weinstein scandal. But that recently, right, that show just finished existing. I don't know, a few years ago, there was a movie of it. And that was an undisguised celebration of this exact world of kind of, you know, the achievement of enough power in Hollywood to become a sexual mogul who can trade in mm-hmm. female flesh.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think a key revelation here is not only his behavior, but people, women especially, hammering home the point that for a man to use power to get sex is almost by definition a sadistic act. That, I mean, I can't speak to what happened between Harvey Weinstein or anybody. I find the accounts completely credible. I want to be clear about that. But just extrapolating from them and assuming, you know, a degree of veracity to them, I mean, you're not just acquiring sex in that transaction. You are experiencing your own power through the helplessness of the person in whom, you know, you are instilling a sufficient amount of fear to get them to perform acts they would not otherwise perform. And I think it's important. One of the ways that this may stop is when it becomes clear that that is among the ugliest things a human being can do to another human being. And the idea that you would do it, it will occur to some of these men that between them and their desire will come the realization that they're acting as monsters and not as cool kids or as moguls or as mockers or as Nietzschean, you know, supermen, but really as filthy, filthy scumbags. And maybe something, some of the bite of desire that they feel or think they're feeling will give way to that. And I think among the things that are coming out now is just what it is to use power to get sex.
Before we wrap this segment up, I do want to say, I think we should sort of tip our cap or, you know, what, throw them in the air, whatever we do, to Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, who rigorously reported this story, got it in the Times, got people to use their names, go on record. I mean, it's an incredible piece of journalism as well that has had an immediate impact on this issue, and is just a really an incredible piece of reporting.
Oh, completely agree, and I feel like that did get lost in the responses to it. I mean, there's been so many stories about, as you said, people who have either tried to report this story or decided not. Rebecca Traister wrote about considering pursuing the story and deciding not to for various reasons, including that Harvey Weinstein had physically threatened and attacked her then boyfriend at one party. And the fact that Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey had the courage and the rigor and took the time to really report the story outright may change the history of Hollywood.
All right. Well, on that note, this is one to talk about, right? I mean, this is the disinfectant is going to be sunlight. So if you feel the urge, come talk to about it with us at facebook.com/culturefest or anywhere. But here's hoping against hope, and era has come to an end. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dinah. What do you have?
Stephen, I have a double endorsement this week. I'm going to go long. I'm going to be a you for a week and endorse two things. The first is a very sobering, long-reported article in The Guardian by Paul Lewis that's about so many things. I mean, it is essentially about a group of tech executives from Silicon Valley who have now really soured on social media and are really rethinking essentially the consequences of what they've been inventing for the past few years. And some of them, to varying degrees, are getting off of social media. Others are working within the industry from this ethics angle of sort of trying to figure out the negative consequences of this persuasive technology that they're inventing. For example, the inventor of the Facebook like button, the designer who first coded that button and got us all into this culture of obsessive and addictive liking, has some really, really interesting things to say about the repercussions of that. And it goes way beyond the sort of Pico Iyer style, I personally am going to drop out and go to a Buddhist monastery in southern France, you know, kind of smug Luddite position. And it goes way beyond that and actually really does start to think about what these kind of social media addictions and the effect that they are having in the electoral system and on people's attention span and in all kinds of cultural realms. And it's very sobering to read. It makes you want to change in some way your relationship to the internet while realizing that you're not going to fulfill that Pico Iyer dream of somehow purifying yourself. And everyone I've shown it to, I've sent this link to a few people, everybody has said, this is really making me rethink some things. So that's one of the things I'm endorsing. It's called Our Minds Can Be Hijacked, The Tech Insiders Who Fear a Smartphone Dystopia. It's in The Guardian, and we'll put a link on our show page. My second endorsement is something I've never done before in this segment, but I'm going to endorse an Indiegogo campaign for something that I think is really worthwhile and wonderful and that I contributed to recently. So this past weekend, I went to the International Buster Keaton Society Convention in Muskegon, Michigan. I went in part to interview some people and report from there, and also just because I had always wanted to go. This is just sort of, you know, the ground zero of the Buster Keaton weeds. Like, if you don't find somebody who knows the stuff that you want to find out there, you're not going to find them anywhere. And it was a wonderful weekend. It was much more than just scholarly talks. There was a live musical. There was a magic show. There was a baseball game on the field where Buster Keaton used to play as a teenager. It was a great event that I recommend to anybody who wants to go and maybe take their kid to a really, really fun weekend in Michigan. But one of the missions of the society is, of course, to preserve the legacy of Buster Keaton. And like everything else about Hollywood history, you know, silent film history has a way of disappearing and burying itself. And L.A., God love it, has not been that historically great at preserving its monuments. It's always building over places that were absolutely crucial to the growth of the film industry and leaving them either unmarked or mismarked. And that is certainly the case with Keaton. So this studio where he worked from, I believe it was 1920 to 1929 or so, in which he made basically all of the great silent films that we know him for, two reelers and features as well. It's located on the corner of Lillian Way and Eleanor Street, I believe, in L.A. I don't know what neighborhood that is because I'm not enough of an L.A. knower. And there is actually a marker there, but the marker is on the wrong corner, so it is not actually at the site where the studio was. Oh, I forgot to mention that Chaplin also worked in this same building, right? So it was a very historic Hollywood site. Chaplin worked there before Keaton took it over. And the marker that's there is inaccurate, illegible, and in the wrong place. So one of the things the Buster Keaton Society is trying to do is make a better plaque, one that will last, put it in the right place with accurate information, and make it a place that people touring around Los Angeles can actually see a little piece of history. So if you want to contribute to this campaign, they're, I think, about $5,000 away from reaching their goal, and they have 20 more days to do it. We'll put a link on the show page to the Indiegogo site where you can go and help restore a plaque for Buster Keaton Studios in Hollywood.
Love it. Isaac, what do you got?
I also have two recommendations. The first is an album that came out, I think, a year ago on New Amsterdam. It's by the jazz trumpeter and band leader Amir El Safar and his Two Rivers Ensemble. And the album is called Not Two, as in the number two, Not Two. It's a really, really gorgeous, vital, driving, groovy blending of jazz traditions and North African and Middle Eastern traditional musical traditions. And a lot of times when people kind of try to mold those kinds of work, it winds up having a certain lack of specificity. It doesn't really resonate. But this album is absolutely gorgeous. It works both as a jazz album and as a North African album. And it's recorded all on analog tape. So it has a really beautiful full sound. I really can't recommend it highly enough. It's one of my favorite things that I've listened to this year. That's Amir El Safar and Two Rivers Ensemble's Not Two on New Amsterdam Records. And the second thing I want to recommend is a graphic novel that almost didn't come out because the shipping company that was bringing it to our shores went out of business and the boat that it was in was seized. But it's here and it's brilliant. And that's Emile Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters, Volume 1. It's this absolutely incredible work that takes the form of a 10-year-old a comic book and monster movie fanatic's kind of visual cartoon diary of her day-to-day life in late 60s Chicago. And it is wonderful. It's this kind of sui generis work that is about being, you know, working class in Chicago. It's also about the Jewish American immigrant experience and the Holocaust. It's about monster movies. It's about a little girl trying to solve the mysteries of her family and her apartment building and day-to-day life. And it is one of the most inventively drawn and put together things I've ever read. Maybe one of the best graphic novels of the decade. And that is Emile Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters, Volume 1.
Magnificent. All right. Well, Dana, you know, on a day that you endorse two things, that means I have to endorse how many, you think? Seven?
I don't know what the algorithm is, but yeah, it's definitely an exponential multiplication.
Yeah. All right. Well, but so it's going to be with immense restraint that I only endorse three things. The first, very quickly, is Tom Petty will not leave me. I'm sure he never will, but it's been very intense in the aftermath of his really premature death. But he was so good. And just to give people who really quickly, just go to YouTube and listen to him do the old Solomon Burke classic "Cry to Me." Live at the No Nukes concert. I think there's only audio right now up on YouTube, but it just shows you how tight that band was and what a good singer he was. I mean, really underrated singer. He used to kind of do more singing maybe in the 70s during some of those old, I had a bootleg of him from like 75. I just, you know, in which he did that song "Cry to Me" so beautifully. And just the harmonies of the band, that band was fucking tight. Tom Petty is so missed. Very quickly, in Troy, New York, Dana, I know you're going to be there next week. It's called Sun Hee's Farm and Kitchen. It's a Korean food joint in Troy. It is so good. If you are anywhere near the Capital District, seek them out for lunch or for dinner. There's also a really cool bar attached to it. Those guys are doing great frickin' work. And finally, I've only just discovered and caught up with the band called Yumi Zuma. I don't know if anyone knows them. Just really poignant, dreamy, weird pop music.
Stephen, our intern Daniel is pumping his fist in the booth. He apparently loves Yumi Zuma.
Oh man, Daniel, my bro. No, I love these guys. And there's like, you can look it up. They're like kind of, there's kind of an interesting gimmick where they live, one of them lives in Paris, one in New York, and one in New Zealand. And they drop box a lot of the tracks and then blend them into the band. But it's just fantastic dream pop. That I was amazed I hadn't discovered already. So if you like them, tell me about it on Facebook. All right. Isaac, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
Full SFOP now, special friend of the program. I don't know about ultimate, but I think we're definitely at SFOP. Dana, what do you think?
All right. Then he has to come back to keep on struggling for that ultimate status.
I would love to do so. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's like Scientology, really. There are levels. And, Dana, thank you so much. That was a blast.
Great show. Thanks, Steve.
All right, you'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. You can email us, as always, at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. Andy Bowers, he's, as always, the chief poobah officer, the CPO of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of Panoply, so there's an entire roster of very like-minded but also quite diverse shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Isaac Butler and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.